Hi, it's Mountain Edition. All the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. This week, mysterious bottles are turning up along the Roaring Fork River. The city of Aspen says going au natural at the Arc Pool is healthy. And government officials think it's time to rethink the management of affordable housing.
Also, Colorado Mountain College is cutting tuition for some students and raising it for others. And warming temperatures continue to contribute to beetle infestations in Colorado's forests.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. Elected officials from Aspen, Snowmass Village, and Picking County will discuss spending $40,000 to analyze the need for an improved pedestrian crossing at Buttermilk.
Elizabeth Stewart Savory reports.
Pitkin County officials are concerned about the safety of pedestrians at the busy spot on the highway. But at their last meeting, the Transportation Committee rejected a similar proposal to study improvements because of cost. The proposed study would analyze safety, cost, and options like an underpass or a bridge for the crossing. The board has budgeted $8 million for construction. But Brian Pettit, who is Pitkin County's Public Works Director, says the actual project cost would likely be much higher. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
Last week, Basalt police found a collection of bottles in the Roaring Fork River wrapped in duct tape with a mysterious liquid inside.
As Wyatt Orm reports, authorities want the public to know, do not open them.
Basalt police estimate around 40 to 50 of these bottles have been found along the river between Basalt and Glenwood Springs since late January when the first were discovered. Last week, officers in Basalt found 18 more. Most have been filled with a bluish liquid and a, quote, paper-like substance. It's still unclear what the contents are exactly, but they're corrosive, flammable, and potentially damaging. One theory is that they're a waste product from a drug-making operation. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
The U.S. Forest Service received 11 objections to a draft decision on a logging project in the Upper Frying Pan Valley.
Elizabeth Stewart Severy has been following the issue. She broke it down in the studio with Claire Woodcock.
So, who's opposed to this project?
Well, there's been strong opposition from some home and property owners near the project area. There are environmental groups who filed objections as well, including the Roaring Fork Audubon Society and Wilderness Workshop. The town of Basalt filed an objection, and so did a company called Montrose Forest Products, which would receive some of the timber from this project.
So, those groups have some varied interests and concerns. Are there any common threads there?
Yeah, so safety, recreation, and environmental concerns, ecological concerns are pretty common themes from the homeowners, government, and environmental groups. One of the objections from a homeowner actually has 12 people signed on to it, and these are people who say this is a recreation area, it is not appropriate to log here at all. Several of these objectors want to see more environmental analysis and certain areas removed from the project. For example, there are units that overlap with proposed wilderness areas, and Wilderness Workshop has asked the Forest Service to remove those. The Roaring Fork Audubon Society is concerned about groves of aspen trees that are included right now, but the Montrose Forest Product Company concerns are pretty different.
So what are the grounds for their objection?
This company relies pretty heavily on timber from national forests for their mill. Their objection focuses on cost. Right now, rather than include kind of one really big area that would be clear cut, there are smaller units that are spread out in pockets across the upper frying pan. The Montrose Company says it's really difficult and expensive to get equipment into these relatively small areas, so they're asking the Forest Service to include larger areas.
Okay, and what is the Forest Service response, and what are some of the next steps?
Yeah, so right now the regional office of the Forest Service considers the objection. They will go through all of the initial comments and the Forest Service analysis to be sure that the Forest Service fully addressed all of the initial concerns and that the analysis was complete. I spoke with Deputy District Ranger Erin Carey at the Forest Service. She says they feel quite confident that they've fully analyzed the project, but also that it's good to see this much public involvement. None of these objections necessarily came as a surprise based on past comments, but they will wait to see what the regional office determines. The regional office now will go through all those objections, talk with all the people who objected, and then they can do a couple different things. They can change the decision. They can add or remove acreage from the project. They can also ask for further analysis, which is what several of the objectors are asking for, or they can find that the Forest Service was accurate in deciding that there's no significant environmental impact and they can move forward with the project as it is.
That was Elizabeth Stewart Severy talking with Claire Woodcock about the draft decision on logging in the Upper Frying Pan Valley. 8 years ago, an earthquake in northern Mexico set in motion a big change in how people think about the lowest reaches of the Colorado River. The quake destroyed irrigation canals, leaving farmers unable to use all of their water. So Mexico began storing it in the U.S. And after a couple international agreements, the surplus temporarily flowed into the river's driest reaches.
Luke Runyon asks, will that ever happen again?
It was called the Pulse Flow, and it happened in 2014. That's when the last dam on the Colorado River at the Mexican border was lifted, and water spilled into the final 100 miles of the dry riverbed. Here's how NPR covered it.
Recently, Mexican and American officials agreed and decided to lift the Morelos Dam.
Between the U.S. and Mexico, water is flowing to the Delta once again, temporarily.
The first time ever that water has been released to benefit the environment. It's called a pulse flow because it mimics a spring flood.
It was so intense, the Colorado River actually made it all the way to the Pacific Ocean for the first time in 20 years. Kids who'd never seen it in its natural channel splashed and played, birds returned, and trees and marshes greened up. But within a few months, it was dry again.
The pulse flow was in 2014, and we're, you know, almost 4 years after, and the community is trying to find ways to restore a portion of the river there because what they experienced during the pulse flow.
Francisco Zamora is the director of the Colorado River Delta Program at the Sonoran Institute in Tucson, Arizona. He had a role in making the pulse flow happen. So many of you might be wondering the same thing that listener Glenn Patterson asked us.
Are we likely to see more such pulse flows and perhaps more frequently or for a longer time? Thanks.
And that's exactly what Zamora and a group of environmentalists and scientists are now trying to figure out. A key consideration of any future releases is to apply what they found out from the first one. Jennifer Pitt is the Colorado River Program Director with the National Audubon Society. I caught up with her at a water conference in Las Vegas.
It enabled us to learn so much about how water moves through that ecosystem that we really had no way of knowing because there haven't been regular flows in that reach of the river for decades.
And here's the biggest takeaway. Because the Delta is so dry and the water table so low, the vast majority, more than 90% of the pulse flow, just seeped into the sandy riverbed. It boosted the groundwater, but it didn't stay on the surface long enough to provide a huge benefit to the birds and people.
So with what we learned, we are now applying an approach to water deliveries that is trying to optimize the benefit we get for vegetation regrowth, for the birds, to keep the birds happy, and for people.
That new approach is one piece of a U.S.-Mexico agreement signed last fall. It calls for more water to be used specifically for environmental restoration in the Delta over the next 8 years. Pitt is a member of a panel tasked with divvying up the water. Going forward, she says, don't expect simulated floods. Releases will be more targeted and spread out over time.
But it doesn't mean that there won't be flows through the channel that reach the sea. They may not look exactly like the 2014 pulse flow did, but we have more water to work with under the new minute than we did under the last, and we're excited to see what we can do.
But Francisco Zamora is concerned about the decades of environmental degradation the Delta has already experienced. All of this would be a lot easier, he says, if there was just more water to go around. But the Colorado River is already overdrawn. Do you feel hopeful for the Colorado River Delta?
I do. Yes, I do. Despite the fact of, you know, the conditions in the basin, the climate and the water supply, I think what we have learned during the last 20 years gives me hope.
What's wrapped up in all of this, though, is a recognition between the two countries that rely on the Colorado River that they can do very little by themselves. Both the U.S. and Mexico will have to work together, and each will have to give something up in order to restore the river's driest areas. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story was produced in partnership with the public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support from the Walton Family Foundation.
You're listening to Mountain Edition. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. If you're a dedicated Aspen Public Radio listener, you know the kind of local news and programming you can count on every week.
Every week, you hear news coverage in Morning Edition, plus local programs like Cross Currents, Valley Roundup, and Mountain Edition that you can't find anywhere else.
Your support makes our coverage of the Roaring Fork Valley possible. In fact, Aspen Public Radio is largely funded by listeners just like you who contribute.
The Many Voices One Valley Pledge Drive is coming up, and your early donations can help shorten the drive.
Please make your tax-deductible contribution now at aspenpublicradio.org or call us 920-9000. And thank you for your support.
The city of Aspen says a natural filter at the Aspen Recreation Center pool has improved the water quality. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has more.
The ARC pool has been using a type of moss to clean the water for 9 months. In that time, staff says they've noticed cleaner air and water and fewer cases of dry skin and green hair. Erin Hutchings manages operations at the ARC.
Basically, it's a natural clarifier. It's natural, it's compostable. It's awesome.
The sphagnum moss is in a tea bag-like case in the filtration system, and it can help eliminate sweat, urine, and body oils from the pool. This means the city can use less chlorine, and Hutchings says they've cut up to 10 pounds of it per week. But they haven't cut out the chemical altogether.
You're never going to get away from using chlorine in all pool settings.
Hutchings helped start the program with an environmental grant from the city. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Aspen Councilmember Adam Frisch expressed concern about the Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority at a council meeting this week.
For weeks, Frisch has been meeting individually with Pitkin County leadership about the joint governance of the Housing Authority. While the two governments have overseen the agency for its 40-year history, Frisch says there's an imbalance in the resources that go into running the program. He wants to look at other management options in the future.
My prism has always been, if something was to start from scratch, would this be the way we should operate? And through that prism, I'm losing the ability to take anyone seriously that the status quo is best for our community.
Frisch urged a work session to address the matter as soon as possible. The idea was supported by the rest of council.
So, Allison, that was your story about Adam Frisch's concern about oversight of APSHA. He asked the council plan a work session as soon as possible to discuss the way the department is managed. And I know that we are going to have a lot more questions.
That's right. I sat down with Carolyn Hellman to dig a little bit deeper into what that might look like.
So Frisch takes issue with the balance of authority between the city council and the county commissioners. Can you explain that a bit more?
Sure. The program has been set up in such a way that the county and city have equal voting power when it comes to APSHA guidelines, but the city has more funding to put toward the program. In addition, the authority is actually its own entity with its own board as well, so that we have three separate groups that all have to approve any proposed change to the system. At a time when the department is trying to get lots of new initiatives off the ground as far as data collection to allow us to see what's going on in the housing stock, each budget request has made its way through all three committees, and Frisch is calling this clunky and antiquated. Here he is at Monday's meeting.
God forbid it is bad that every 40 years we have a discussion on how the most important program in our community is being governed. There have been some drastic changes that, in my humble opinion, call this current structure outdated.
Last May, I reported that some of these cracks were beginning to show between the county and city. Frisch and the city staff worked on a huge capital reserve solution, hoping to avoid issues of deterioration with the ownership units. Their plan was voted down by the county commissioners, which shows that the two governments do have underlying differences to the point that some things can get stymied.
So it sounds like the city is getting frustrated with the joint governance model. How's the county feel about it?
I spoke with Patty Clapper. She's the chairman of the Pitkin County Board of County Commissioners. She and the county are open to having the discussion about future management of APSHA. She actually spoke along similar lines to Frisch about some of those funding inequities in the program. I think it's kind of a case where both sides think they're getting the short end of the stick.
It's an interesting scenario because the county and the city split half and half the operating expenses. We have very limited resources for housing, affordable housing. So, you know, there's an imbalance there, but I don't really know if that's the issue.
She went on to say she doesn't really know what the issue is. She's declined to meet with Frisch, who has been having these one-on-one meetings with county leaders. She says she wants the conversation to be out in the open and include everyone, so perhaps at the next joint session of the two governments.
So what would be on the table at a joint session?
Frisch sees three paths that this discussion could lead to. One is just to rework the contract, but keep the two bodies somewhat involved. So maybe they meet more often or rearrange who is overseeing each particular thing. Option two is mirroring what's happening on the Front Range, where housing authorities really are independent. We could have a housing authority that doesn't report to the mayor or the commissioners. They collect money and oversee the program all on their own. Right now, what Adam is leading toward is that basically APSHA gets handed over from the county to the city. The work session Adam asked for on Monday has now been scheduled for March 5th, so we'll learn more then.
Thanks, Allison.
The Poets in Schools program brings spoken word artists to area schools to run writing workshops with students for 2 weeks, and it culminates with students performing their original work at the annual Youth Poetry Slam. Kristen sat down with Mercedes Holtry, a resident poet.
It's super important, I think, because as young people, we're told that our voice doesn't necessarily count or matter because we're young. And so when we go into these high schools and we tell these young people, hey, this is a chance for you to be real. This is a chance for you to be honest. This is a chance for you to say all the things that you've been wanting to say, but you hold back because either adults make you feel like you can't say these things, or your peers pressure you into thinking it's not cool, or even just society in general is telling you all the things to get you not to express yourselves and to hold it in and to be this composed, mature person. And I think it's important to use poetry as a tool so that these young people can understand that expression is one of the best ways to not only heal yourself, but heal others around you.
Why is that step necessary, like powerful enough to go into classrooms and encourage kids to write? That there's this extra step of reading out loud in front of your community. So why? Why does that matter?
I feel like as humans, any type of testimony that is spoken aloud is a living proof that we have the ability to change others with our words and with our speech. And so to make this event public is just a way for us to kind of acknowledge each other and to say, hey, you're human. You're speaking that story out loud, and I connect to that story. That actually happens to me, too. If they weren't saying that out loud, they had kept it in their notebook or on their page, it would end there.
Are there specific kids who you know have been impacted by this?
Today, a fifth grader actually wrote about her mom having cancer. And for her to even say that in front of an entire fifth grade class is super brave. And I think bravery is like what these kids gain out of this program. Like they just understand that like this is vulnerable and I don't want to share this information, but hey, these people are encouraging me to be brave. And the rest of these students seem to be really receptive and really accepting. And so then you get someone sharing that personal deep story, and then you have other students being super compassionate and showing empathy. So I think the youth here have definitely grown.
That was Mercedes Holtry. The Youth Poetry Slam will take place tomorrow, February 16th, at the 3rd Street Center in Carbondale. You can find Cross Currents online at aspenpublicradio.org to hear more of that conversation. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, Verizon needs to fix its, quote, very unreliable service, says Basalt's mayor.
The Wheeler Opera House hosted a play about the personal stories people often keep to themselves.
The 2018 artist list for the JAS Aspen Snowmass Labor Day Experience has been released, and it features Valley favorites. Single-day tickets went on sale this week.
Missouri Heights is under the microscope at a meeting today in El Jebel.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org. Colorado Mountain College is lowering tuition for students pursuing a bachelor's degree, but it's raising costs for students in associate-level courses. Wyatt Orm reports.
Full-time students at CMC taking upper-level classes will save nearly $600 in tuition next school year. The majority of students, though, take lower-level or associate-level classes, think Bio 101. Their tuition is going up. But Matt Giameschi, who's CMC's chief operating officer, says tuition is one financial consideration.
Attending college is not just tuition. It's tuition and fees and books, and as well as time and travel and computers and everything else that goes into it.
CMC has a new book leasing system, so what students pay in new tuition will be offset by lower book prices. All told, students in associate-level classes can expect to see their overall costs increase by 1%, or about $30, Giameschi says. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Colorado State Forest Service released the 2017 report on the health of Colorado forests last week.
As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, insects remain a concern.
The report examines the impacts of widespread infestations of bark beetles. The insects have killed roughly one-fifth of Colorado's forests in the past 20 years. The trend continued in 2017. More than 200,000 acres of Colorado's high-elevation spruce forests were infested with spruce bark beetle last year. Another beetle that attacks Douglas firs impacted 1,400 acres in the southern part of the state. Temperature and precipitation can affect forest insects. According to the Colorado Climate Center, the average temperature in the state has increased 2 degrees since the 1980s. Water temperatures are also warmer. The report says these factors contribute to insect and disease outbreaks. The State Forest Service report also focuses on dealing with the dead trees. Colorado has more than 100 sawmills, but that's not enough to harvest and process all the beetle kill wood. There are several programs in the state to minimize impacts of bark beetles, including using pheromone treatments to repel the insects. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Roaring Fork Transportation Authority, or RAFTA, is thinking of asking voters for a new property tax this November. The agency says this would ensure funding for the next 2 decades or so. RAFTA has just had a survey conducted to get a sample of what voters might think about the possible tax.
Elizabeth Stewart Severy sat down with Wyatt Orme to talk about the details.
So Wyatt, what would the money be used for if it is granted?
It would expand RAFTA's services, so more weekend services, potentially more BRT, and especially kind of get these services going more in the off-season. All that without raising fares considerably.
Okay, so what did the survey show about what RAFTA has going for it and against it?
RAFTA has some wind at its back because of what the survey considers a favorable political climate. Mm-hmm. Voters across the board are concerned about traffic congestion, whether for environmental reasons or just because no one likes being stuck in traffic. It seems also that for the most part, voters in the Roaring Fork Valley think they get pretty good bang for their buck when they're taxed.
But it probably depends on how much they're being taxed, right?
Definitely.
How much are we talking about here?
Yeah, and I should say that the main problem for those who are opposed to another tax is just that, it's another tax.
Mm-hmm.
But the survey floated 2 numbers by their sample group, and the option is basically between 22 or 36 additional dollars each year for every $100,000 of assessed residential property value.
Okay.
On the whole, there does seem like there's some price sensitivity. Voters will more likely support a new tax if it's closer to the $22 option instead of the $36 option.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this survey?
So in late January, a consulting firm called 300 likely voters, not registered voters. They took a sample of the voters who are most likely going to turn out in the upcoming election. And over the course of about 15 minutes, the pollsters asked them 35 questions. In a nutshell, the survey found that getting a mill levy passed for RAFTA is within reach. But according to the consulting firm, it will not be a slam dunk.
Okay, so what is RAFTA doing to garner support to try to hit that slam dunk?
Yeah, so maybe a slam dunk is not in the forecast. And of course, you know, polls can be wrong. But what it comes down to now is really a matter of messaging and education. So if all of RAFTA's different partners come together, and that's everyone from Aspen to Pitkin County, Snohomish Village, Eagle County, Basalt, Carbondale, and Glenwood Springs. Also, it goes down to Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
If they all kind of have consistent messaging that shows that they're all on board with a new tax, then it's probably going to have a much better chance with voters.
Okay, thank you, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
Carbondale native Peter Olenek is a freestyle skiing pioneer and an 11-time X Games competitor who won 4 medals in 3 different events. This winter, he'll be at the 2018 Winter Olympics representing the home team. Olenek is the coach of the South Korean freestyle ski team.
Elizabeth Stewart Severy caught up with him on a quick trip home before he took off for Pyeongchang and brings us this report.
Peter Olenek doesn't speak much Korean, but he knows what he'll be yelling at the top of the halfpipe this weekend.
Kaja, 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 which is like, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. And I just yell as fast as I can, and I think they all blush when I do it.
How are ya?
Just before taking off for Pyeongchang, Olenek was home for 1 ski day with his family.
Look at Mama Molly, the ambassador.
I know. What?
His mom Molly, his brother, and his first student, his sister Meg, a top-level slope-style skier. He coached her through her entire career.
From when I learned my first 360 when I was 13 years old till the last Olympic qualifier in 2014, He kind of always just reminded me, like, you're out here to have fun, and this run is just like any other run in the park.
Meg says he's like a big brother to all his athletes. Olenek has been coaching the Korean ski team for 3 years to prepare for their home Olympics. It's paid off. South Korea is sending its biggest team to the 2018 Games, and their training has been particularly intense in the last couple of months.
We've been pushing pretty hard, and they're trying to learn a bunch of new tricks.
The three-member team is young. Yujin Yang and Kangbok Lee, who compete in halfpipe, are 16 and 17. And Mihun Lee, who competes in slopestyle, is 23. So Olenek says this competition will be a learning experience, just like the past 3 years have been for them all. The South Korean ski team started looking for a coach with top-level competition experience after the Sochi Olympics. Olenek fit the bill and jumped right in, despite the cultural gaps. Like, he's a picky eater and speaks very little Korean.
And no real sentences, just random words or a little phrase or something.
All of his athletes have taken English classes at school, so they communicate in English, which Olenek says was stilted at first. And it's taken him some time to get used to other elements of Korean culture.
They have lots of rules. Everything is like perfect on time, schedule, and I'm not so good at the rules or the schedule.
Olenek comes from the first generation of park skiers, which was a little more on the counterculture side. But there are some definite upsides to being a coach in Korean ski culture.
They're all a lot more respectful of authority and everyone above them, and they do everything I tell them to do, which is nice.
Plus, they've spent a lot of time together. Olenek and the team spend most of the summer in South Korea, training in the gym and on the airbag. And in the winter,
I can pretty much just point to a country on the map, and if there's snow there, I go there at some point.
It's a lifestyle that Olenek is used to from his own competitive days. But when he was a top-ranked free skier, Olympic years were always bittersweet.
Every year that the Olympic cycle would come around, it would be like, I wish we could be doing it.
Olenek competed in slopestyle and halfpipe, Olympic events for snowboarders from 1998 on. Skiers, though, had to wait much longer.
2010 was very close, and everyone thought we were going to get in.
If that had happened, it's likely Olenek would have been there. He was healthy and strong and putting down solid runs at competitions across the world. But park skiing didn't make the Olympic lineup until 2014, after Olenek had retired.
I tried coming back from some other injuries to make it to 2014, and I couldn't.
But he's recaptured a bit of that competitive spirit through coaching. And Olenek says he hasn't lost the feeling of what it's like to be the one dropping into the pipe.
Before their runs, like, I'm actually nervous, like I used to be when I was competing.
And while he's working on following the rules, he still isn't afraid to bend them.
I'm going to definitely, like, poach a couple runs in the pipe and take a picture or two of me really skiing the Olympic pipe once.
This Olympic reality looks a little different than Olenek's dreams, but he still gets that view from the top of the halfpipe, watching the skiers he's nurtured for years have their moment on the world stage. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
The women's slopestyle competition is scheduled for Saturday, and women's halfpipe is on Tuesday, February 20th. Men's halfpipe is scheduled for Thursday, February 22nd.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in for a special Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. Allison, I'm so excited for this. You're talking to Ken Rudin, the political junkie from NPR.
It'll be enlightening and definitely entertaining. Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.